Okay, so today we're continuing on with the Satipatthana Sutta as is found in the Majjhima Nikaya. And yesterday we got to the end of body. So today we'll focus on at least two of the other three foundations of mindfulness, maybe even getting into the third one or the fourth one. Now, you'll see that the contemplation of feelings and the contemplation of the mind are much shorter. If you look in the text, you'll see that there's not nearly as much as is said about the body. And this is generally because using the body is the easiest and the most clear for the meditator. So it's always used as our base in meditation. We're always focusing, always coming back to the body again once there's nothing else. Whereas feelings only become apparent at certain instances, they become clear to the meditator, and thoughts as well. But the body is always, or almost always, quite clear and apparent to the meditator. So it's easy to take as the base, and it's a lot more stable than the mind. So, for instance, the breath is always rising and ceasing, so it's something that you can always come back to. It's an easy thing to find when there's nothing else to pay attention to develop your mind on. But it certainly wouldn't be complete without the other three, and so the Lord Buddha, for this reason, brought up the other three foundations of mindfulness. Contemplation of feeling, here we have the different kinds of feeling as set out in the discourse. We have the three kinds of feeling and then split up into spiritual and worldly. And this is the word here. And I believe the Pali is Samisa, I think, and Niramisa. Samisa, Niramisa. It means basically means bodily and mental. So when we're dealing with feelings, the technical classification is as either a physical feeling in the case of physical pain or physical pleasure or physical neutral feelings. And then mental feelings in terms of mental pleasure, mental displeasure, and neutral mental feeling. Now, as I've talked about before in other texts, when we're dealing with feelings, it's very important to understand that we're trying to accept reality as it is, and so even painful feelings have to become the object of our awareness, the object of our meditation. And as with all of the sections in this sutta, it makes clear this fact by saying that we're simply to know that this is a painful feeling, this is a pleasant feeling, rather than to judge and to only focus on the happy feelings or to stop meditating when we get a happy feeling. And when there's a painful feeling, to find some way to get rid of it, to find some way to go back to a peaceful or a calm or a happy state of being. Instead, the Buddha said, Sukhang vavetanang vidyamano, when experiencing a pleasant feeling, the only reaction that's reasonable and that's proper in meditation practice is sukhang vedanang vedayami, which means I experience a pleasant feeling, I experience happiness. And the way we do this in meditation again is by making this thought, this awareness, by shortening it, by making it concise and easy to insert in our meditation. So when we're sitting in meditation and we feel a painful feeling, we say to ourselves, pain, 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 just using the word pain to remind ourselves of this. And the commentary gives an interesting exposition on how this works or why this is. He says, certainly, while they experience a pleasant feeling in sucking the breast and on similar occasions, even infants lying on their backs know that they experience pleasure. But this meditator's knowledge is different. So we're talking about a different kind of awareness than ordinary awareness. I mean, some people will always wonder why you would have to say such things as pain, 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 when you already know that it's pain. And this is the answer. The answer is that, well, everyone knows that there's pain, and yet no one gains any special spiritual knowledge or understanding based on that. There's no use in simply knowing that there's pain, because even infants are aware that they have pleasure, are aware that they have pain. But that kind of knowledge does not cast out the belief in a being, does not root out the perception of a being, does not become the subject of meditation, and does not become the cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. The meaning here is when an ordinary person experiences pleasure, they think it's I that am experiencing it. And so as a result, as I've mentioned in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Lord Buddha points out that we will take it as being me, as being mine. We will attach to it based on clinging. We will attach to it based on our view. We will give rise to a view that this is mine, this is me, I am this. And as a result, we'll suffer when it disappears. We'll suffer when it changes. And when there's painful feelings, we suffer because of them, not because of them directly, but because of our inability to see them as they are. We're like crazy people. When there's something ordinary arises, like a painful feeling, we go crazy about something that is really just an experience. We cry and we wail and we get very, very upset, even to the point where we might want to end our lives based on physical or mental pain. When actually this is simply a phenomenon, and it's such a profound teaching for us. But if you've practiced meditation, it seems like such an obvious thing, that there's really nothing special about a painful feeling, or really nothing special about a pleasant feeling either. And another interesting thing here is the Lord Buddha points out neutral feelings, which are generally something that we don't focus on in meditation. If we don't have a teacher, if we're practicing on our own, or even some teachers will try to encourage the experiencing of neutral feelings and say that this is the goal, is to experience a neutral feeling. But here the Buddha was very clear that even neutral feelings, we should be aware of them, clearly aware, pachanati. We should know thoroughly or perfectly that this is a neutral feeling and not be attached to it. And the commentary explains how this goes, that, you know, people ask the question, well, how do you know that you've got a neutral feeling? There's just no feeling. It's like nothing. And they give a simile of a deer. When a hunter goes to find a deer, they see the tracks of the deer on this side and the tracks of the deer on that side, but there's a big rock, what do you call it, platform, bedrock where the soil has eroded away in the middle. And so when he gets to the end of the track and then there's this big rock, he doesn't know whether the deer went across the rock, but he sees the hoof tracks on this side and the hoof tracks on the other side, and so he knows that the deer passed by that one as well. So when painful feeling disappears and then there's no happy feeling, then we know that there's a neutral feeling. Or when happy feeling disappears and there's no painful feeling, that's when we know that there's a neutral feeling as well. The point being, when there is no feeling, then there still is a feeling. When we become aware that there is no pain and there is no pleasure, that is a neutral feeling. Especially in the beginning, when this is not easy to see, people will often become attached to calm sensations or peaceful, quiet and quiet experiences, emptiness, feelings of emptiness, and so on. This is simply a experience of a neutral feeling. And again, as for painful feelings, there's an interesting story about this elder monk. I think I'll just copy it in here for all of you to read and make your own judgment about it. I think it's just a funny story. I can't paste the whole thing in. Anyway, here it is. You can read that as you just take your time and read that. I'm just going to move on. I'll explain a little bit. The idea in this story is that when you practice meditation, you can actually get to the point where the body is simply an experiential phenomenon. It's nothing special. It's nothing to be attached to. And so there's this young monk thinking he's all great and telling the elder that he should bear up. The elder, he's probably a pretty experienced meditator, and so he wasn't complaining or anything, but he just bears up, and then it's like his intestines fall out. And he says to the young man, is that okay? Am I doing good yet? And the young monk has nothing to say to that. So it's clear from this and from many other passages that at the very least we can put up with moderate or mild painful sensations, and there should be no complaining about pain or thinking that it is somehow a bad thing. And then there's the standard, at the end of the section, there's the standard exposition of how therefore one is aware of internal or external sensations, and one is aware of the beginning of the sensations and the ending of the sensations, whether they be painful or pleasant. One is aware of them from beginning to end. And again, seeing things from beginning to end is very important, because it starts to give us this realization that everything arises and ceases, and allows us to, in the end, let go of everything and be content with anything. So next, going on to the cittanupassana, which is the mindfulness of the mind, or the contemplation of consciousness. Actually, mind, I think, is a better translation, but I know consciousness is also widely used. It means the same thing. But here, mind means our state of mind. In the tradition that I follow, we actually sort of circumvent this section and just say mind is thinking. Whether it's good thoughts or bad thoughts, in the end it's all just thoughts. And this is because a lot of these different classifications of consciousness are going to also be found in Dhammanupassana, in the fourth section, when we start talking about the hindrances, and the negative emotions, the things which are going to bog us down, whether they exist or do not exist. So it's really a repeat in some ways. So especially for beginner meditators, we just cut this section down to thinking. When you're thinking anything, if it's good or bad or whatever, you just say to yourself, thinking. But since the sutta goes this way, it is more appropriate, if we're going to give a complete exposition, to talk about these things. So we're dealing with states of mind where your mind has lust or not, or doesn't have lust, when the mind has anger or doesn't have anger, sattho sang cittang, vitattho sang cittang. The mind has delusion or ignorance, the mind is without delusion or without ignorance. And again, all of this is simply to make clear that in meditation, first of all, these are the things we have to look at, and second of all, that we're not to make any distinction. Some people say that before you can practice the four foundations of mindfulness, you have to develop samatha or tranquility. Your mind has to be calm first and has no anger, has no greed, no delusion. And this is simply not true, and easy to see why it's not true based on this discourse. Once you read the discourse, you see that it's clear that even if your mind is full of lust, you can still take that as a meditation object. And why is that? Because this is what we're trying to learn about. We're trying to come to understand our greed, understand our anger, understand our delusion. If we were to just repress it, we would never learn anything about it. We would never really understand why it's a bad thing. If it really is a bad thing, then it should be apparent from a close examination of it. You see, it's a very scientific thing. We're not talking about faith or belief or blind, close your eyes and meditate. You should really be able to discover for yourself the truth. And this is only to be had by a radical introspection or perfectly objective observation. when the mind has delusion, then knowing that it has delusion, when it is without delusion. Sankhitang kittang, this is the shrunken state of consciousness. The shrunken state of consciousness refers to sloth and torpor, when the mind is drowsy or lazy, when the mind, this is when you feel tired in meditation, you feel yourself falling asleep, you can't take any object clearly. And there is a, this is a tough one for most meditators, even meditators who I've taught, you know, as their teacher. It can be very difficult, but if you're clever, if you're good at it, when you're in a meditation course, you can really catch the drowsiness up in your mind. And this is exactly what the Buddha is talking about here. This is a very practical teaching. I want to stress throughout this sutta that this sutta is an incredibly practical exposition. When you just look at the mind, and when you're aware, clearly aware of the drowsiness, it disappears. It just, like it was never there, it vanishes. And this is only to be gotten through intensive meditation, but it's something that you can realize if you put your heart into it. And so these things are going to be hindrances later on in the next section, but in this section we're just talking about the different states of mind. And keeping in mind that for a beginner meditator, it's sometimes easier just to take the mind as being any state of mind, whatever you're thinking about, and just say to yourself, thinking, thinking, when the mind is clear. Vikitang jitang is the opposite, the distracted state of mind, where you're thinking too much. And again, this will become clear in the next section. Mahakatang jitang, amahakatang jitang, so great states of consciousness or not great states of consciousness. This is based on tranquility meditation or absorption meditation. When the mind is absorbed, one knows that it's absorbed. When the mind is not yet absorbed, one knows that it is not yet absorbed. Has some other mental state superior to it, and no other mental state superior to it. This is again based on, it's the same as the last section, based on tranquility meditation. The quieted state of consciousness, the not quieted state of consciousness, these are all states of meditative states. And again, this is should drive home the point that in meditation we're not trying to judge one state or another. When your mind is focused, you know that it's focused. When your mind is not focused, you know that it's not focused. And again, this is different from a tranquility meditation practice or a transcendental meditation practice, where the object is to focus the mind, and that's preferable to a distracted state of mind. In insight meditation, we're trying to see the truth of reality, whatever that reality may be. And this is what leads to true tranquility of mind, once we're able to accept any state of mind and not need any specific meditation experience to make us happy. The freed state of consciousness and the unfreed state of consciousness. This refers instead to the fruit of insight meditation, when the mind comes to realize the truth and lets go and is therefore freed, or the mind is still attached. The idea again is just to be aware of all sorts of states of mind, and therefore internally and so on. It goes on with the rest, as has been explained in the other sections. Okay, moving on to the fourth section, is the section on dharmas, dhammanupassana. And here we have the five hindrances. I don't know if everyone has the sutta that we're looking at. If you have been confused and don't know where we are, then please take a look at this. And we're in the fourth section, the section on contemplation of mental objects. So the mental objects, I actually don't like this translation, as usual. I have something wrong with his translation. I mean, I think this is a really good translator. He's done a really good job and a real good service, but there are still always a few things that I disagree with. Why I disagree with here is because mental objects, well, everything is a mental object. Everything can be a mind object. That could be all of the other three. why then we have this special section on Dhamma or Dharma. In this section, as I understand it, it's the teaching of the Lord Buddha. It's just various teachings that we're going to contemplate, right? Because all of the Buddha's teaching, or much of it, is practical and based on meditation practice. So the Buddha has given his exposition on various sets of things, of phenomena. And these are the things that we're going to now use in our meditation. And the first group of teachings that we have to take up are the five hindrances. Often this section, the only exposition I'll give to meditators, the only explanation is the five hindrances, as my teacher would do as well. Because the rest of it can be overwhelming for meditators, and later on we explain the other sections. But here I'll be explaining in order and going through them all, because this is a study of the sutta. The five hindrances are, here they have sensuality, anger, sloth and torpor, agitation and worry, and doubt. And in meditation practice, I always make this a lot easier for meditators to remember and to understand and to put into practice. So we say liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt. These are the five hindrances. What is the meaning of hindrance? These are things which are going to make it difficult for us to see clearly, because the mind is not calm. When we like or want something, then how could we possibly have a direct experience of reality? Our mind is always looking for something else, or thinking about something that is totally conceptual. When we have anger, then again we're not content with what we have in front of us. We don't like the experience. If it's a memory or a sound or a sight or something that makes us angry, then how could we possibly see it clearly? Because it's like our, as the Buddha said, it's like our mind is a pot of water and it's boiling and it's got dye in it and it's got mud in it and it's all stirred up. And so we can't see anything inside of it. We can't see clearly through it. We can't see what's in the water. So that's why these five things are hindrances. When you want to be happy, you can't be happy. When you want to be at peace, you can't be at peace. When you want to see clearly, you can't see clearly. It's because of these five things. So again, a very practical teaching. This is something which we should all bear in mind in our meditation, something that we can use to progress in our meditation. So the first one is sensuality, is desire. And in the commentaries it explains there are six things which lead to casting out of sense desire. And often the commentaries can be pretty, how do you say, I think pedantic is the right word. So it has lots of lists of things, ways to deal with this, ways to deal with that. I mean, in the end we're just taking the Buddha's words, and when we have sensual desire, we examine the sensual desire. We come to see it clearly, and we see actually that sensual desire is based up of many different parts. There's the chemical reactions in the brain, there's the object that we're seeing or hearing, there is the liking of the chemical reaction, the feeling which arises in the brain or in the body based on seeing, and there is the recognition of the object which leads to the chemical reactions. And then there is the seeking after it and clinging to it and so on. And there are many different parts. And so we focus on these different parts and we come to see that actually it's simply things arising and ceasing. And there's nothing there that's really in any way intrinsically good or desirable. But the commentary has a bunch of things. Taking up the sensually inauspicious subject of meditation. Whatever that means, something that is, here we have something that is impure or bad, so taking up the body, as we saw in the section on the body, as a repulsive object or so on, which can be quite useful, as I've said before, on a limited degree. And then practicing jhana on the centrally inauspicious, controlling the faculties, this is very useful. I mean, it goes without saying that meditation is only a part of the practice, that we can't just think that we're going to live our lives however we wish and somehow come back and do away with these hindrances. In our lives, we also have to be guarded. We can't just go and do what we want or say what we want. And I think this applies doubly to second life, which can be an incredibly sensual experience. And because it's not real life, we sort of lose our shame or our sense of guardedness, and we tend to indulge quite intensely in sensual pleasures. I'm not speaking about myself. I don't want to give you the wrong idea of how I use this thing, but from what I've seen about other people and sort of how this place is set up, that it could certainly be used in such a way. And I think there's probably some people who could attest to that, that it's quite a dangerous place. And because of developing this and not guarding the faculties, then it becomes very difficult to meditate. And when people meditate, they have great states of lust and desire that make it difficult for them to sit still. Another useful one, so guarding the senses, guarding the eye, the ear, not just looking at anything, not listening to music all the time or so on. To when you hear things, when you see things, and this is going to be in the next section, actually talking about the senses. But when you see or hear or so on, to be mindful of those things as well as seeing or hearing, which I'll get to in the next one. And then moderation in food is very useful. And this is something that people don't realize, that food can actually be quite a hindrance in meditation. And scientifically, this makes a lot of sense. Food has chemicals in it, and these chemicals react with our brain. Even sugar, it's amazing how much sugar can affect your state of mind. And if there's even a little bit of desire or lust in the mind when you have certain types of food, it can enhance that. Based on even some food nowadays has hormones in it. We know about meat that has hormones and so on. And this can really affect the chemical balance in your brain. So people, there's a funny story I have of this kid in Thailand. I went to see this family, and this kid, he's about 4 years old or 5 years old, and he was just running around the house, running around and screaming, and then he would start crying. And so his mother grabbed him, took him to the kitchen, and gave him a can of Pepsi, I think. It was either Pepsi or Coke, I can't remember. And suddenly he shut up, and he's just sitting there quietly drinking his Pepsi. And I said to her, do you have problems with this kid? Is he normally like this? And she said, oh yeah, he's terrible. He's always hyperactive. I think there's something wrong with him. And I said to her, Yom, and this is what we say in Thai, it means lay woman or lay person. Yom, do you know what's in Pepsi? Did you know that there's more sugar, there's more than a cup of sugar in that can of Pepsi, and more caffeine than a cup of coffee? And she said, oh, there's caffeine in Pepsi? Oh, it was terrible. You should have seen. So I explained this all to her, and I said, no, this isn't, there's no mystery here. She would feed him Pepsi all day. She said, it's the only thing that shuts him up. I said, yeah, but it doesn't last. And since then, it really worked. I asked her later on, of course it worked. I mean, it's a no-brainer, really. But later on, sure enough, he was much quieted down once she stopped feeding him Pepsi. I mean, that's a pretty extreme example, but it's reality, right? We're dealing with reality. Reality is real. You can't say that whatever you put into your body, it's not going to have some effect. And it's amazing how we don't realize the extent of this effect. That even sugar can be a real and real influence and so on. I mean, the hormones and the even various types of food. Fat, of course, is very important in terms of sloth and torpor, because when you eat a lot of fatty foods or so on, they're hard to digest, and therefore the body becomes, the brain becomes sluggish, and the mind is given over to sloth and torpor, and so on. Where are we then? Moderation in food. The sympathy and support of good men in the endeavor. So being supported by people who, not just good men, by people who, by meditation teachers. This means having good company. So all of the hindrances are easily done away with when we're in good company. Sensuality, when we're around people who are, you know, talking and explaining these things and giving examples, or when we're around other people, then we see them practicing, so we take up the meditation practice and we don't follow after our hindrances. There's even the story of people who, teachers who can read their students' mind, and this often freaks people out. When a teacher can read your mind, and when you know he or she can read your mind, it's like, you know, uh-oh, I better stop thinking. There's a story in the suttas about, in the commentaries, I think, about this monk who he heard about, this one laywoman who was able to read monks' minds, and so whatever food the monks wanted, she would get it for them. So every day when the monk said, oh, today I feel like I need salt, or today I feel like I need sugar, sometimes it's really true that you can need certain types of food at certain times because you have a deficiency or something. You can feel it based on the cravings of the body. And so this, I don't think this is really a negative thing, but this monk got greedy about it, and so he said, wow, I want to go and stay with her. And so he went and stayed in the monastery that she was looking after. And then he realized that he was full of lust and full of sensual desire, and he said, oh my God, this woman, you know, I can't bear to go near her. And whenever he went near her, he'd always be afraid that she was reading his mind and she would know what he was thinking and be able to... And it would make him very embarrassed that he would actually be thinking such things. I remember having such an experience a long time ago. I don't think I'll go into that. But it's interesting how some people can just sense your emotions and sense your thoughts based on their meditation practice. And then number six is stimulating talk that helps the accomplishment of the object in view, or is associated with the goal. So it means talking about these things and explaining and discussing, having discussions. I was thinking, I mentioned yesterday, probably something we'll have to talk about. I'd like to see if we could put together a discussion group where there's no leader like me, it's just people sitting around. Maybe there's a facilitator or so on, or even doing debate. Because in Buddhism, discussion can be very useful, where we have group discussions or even group debates, where we would maybe have naughty points in the doctrine. I think the Tibetans would be better at that. I'm not so skilled in debate, although it'd be something I'd like to learn. Maybe we'll talk to Lodro about it. Okay, so and the second one is anger. We're focusing on anger being the opposite of central desire. When there's something pleasant, it leads to anger. When there's something unpleasant, when there's something pleasant, it leads to desire. When there's something unpleasant, it leads to anger. And so the six things that help cast out anger. The first one is taking up the subject of love or metta. Someone who has lots of anger, it can be useful to take up the practice of love, of metta. The second one is the development of the jhana of absorption based on love, which is basically the same thing. The third one is the reflection on one's actions as one's own property, meaning we are the owners of our own actions, that nobody else, or that when someone gets angry, it's they themselves that are going to suffer, that it's they themselves that have to bear the karma of it. When we see that people go according to their karma, their actions, then both we, when we experience painful things, we don't get angry because we see that it's only based on our own actions. When other people are doing bad things, we think that's only going to lead to their suffering. And so we don't get angry at them, we actually feel sympathetic for them that they have to suffer based on their feelings. The study of karma is very useful for giving up anger. Again, in the end, it's just a matter of looking at these things meditatively and coming to understand them and let go of them. But these are sort of generally useful things that can be quite useful for us in daily lives. Number three, the abundance of wise consideration. When we, and this is what I'm talking about, so when we consider wisely, when we look at the situation, we come to see that there's really nothing to be angry about. when we hear someone yelling at us. My teacher, he said, if someone calls you a buffalo, and believe me, in Thailand, buffalo is a huge insult. It's amazing how angry Thai people get at you when you call them a buffalo. It's a cultural thing, I guess. He said, if someone calls you a buffalo, don't get angry. He said, just turn around and look and see if you've got a tail. If you don't have a tail, then you're not a buffalo. And that's his answer to this one. Wise reflection, because it's ridiculous. If someone calls you a buffalo, why do you get angry? You don't have a tail. I mean, you're not a buffalo. Isn't it stupid? Okay, then number... Where'd we go? Sympathetic and helpful companionship of the good. Again, this is the same as the last one. Stimulating talk that assists in the development of the thought of love and the overthrow of anger. So, discussion. Having a teacher and being able to talk to your teacher and have them explain to you how to deal with it. And the third one is sloth and torpor. Now, this is something that I think a lot of people don't even understand the meaning of. I didn't when I heard it first. When I went to meditate, they gave us this list of the five hindrances. It was hilarious. The first one was called, what, sensual desire. Okay, that's understandable. The second one was, I forget what the second one, I think it may have just been ill will. And so, okay, I can understand ill will. But the third one, sloth and torpor, I'm like, where are these guys coming from? And this is because the first translations into English were done by people in Britain about 100 years ago, or over 100 years ago now. And so we're stuck with these old terminology. But I mean, they're good words, they're just not so familiar to us. The meaning here is just laziness, lassitude, it could have to do with boredom, languidity or so on, being lethargic or dizzy or tired. Can be due to eating food. When you eat a large meal, you can get dizzy or drowsy. So the six things that lead to the casting out of sloth and torpor or drowsiness, apart from specifically just saying, finding the drowsiness, seeking it out, which is going to be in here somewhere. The first one is seeing of the reason of sloth and torpor in the fact of eating too much or gluttony. So when we realize that it's because we're eating too much, and this even goes with meditators. I once gave a meditation course in Chiang Mai, and there they fed us milk in the evening. And since then I've stopped drinking such things in the evening. It's really not proper for a monk to have that, since it's a lot so much like food. But at that time I wasn't so strict, and neither was anyone else. So there was this huge group of lay people coming to meditate, and we all had milk in the evening. And I had planned to stay up all night, or at least late at night, but I couldn't do it, and I found myself lying down and falling asleep. And in the morning I was asking people how they had meditated, how late they had stayed up, and so on. And everyone was saying, oh, I was so tired last night, I was so tired last night. And it became apparent that because of drinking this milk, that everyone was quite drowsy. And realizing that, I've given that up. In the evening now, after 12 o'clock, I only drink, say, fruit juice or tea. Not even tea anymore because of the caffeine, but really only fruit juice or some vegetable juice would be the most. Because it can really make you drowsy in the evening for your meditation. The second one, the changing of the postures completely. This is very useful and very important for us to keep in mind, that sometimes when you're doing sitting, you can feel very drowsy. And so as a result, you stand up and do walking meditation. This can also be true for when your mind is too distracted. If the mind is distracted, then you can sit down or lie down. If you feel yourself unable to do walking meditation because your mind is distracted, or even sitting meditation, then you can just lie down and do lying meditation. And if your mind is really distracted, you shouldn't fall asleep. You'll find yourself alert and awake, and your mind will be well balanced. Changing of the postures is a good thing to remember, that we're not just talking about sitting still. Walking meditation was practiced by the Lord Buddha every day, and for this reason, because of the existence of sloth and torpor in an ordinary person. Number four, reflection on the perception of light. Oh, no, this is number three, right? Number three, reflection on the perception of light. Looking at the light, this apparently works. I've never really gotten into this one, although I have done it before. No, this is true. Sometimes when you're meditating all night, for instance, it can be very useful to keep the lights on. People like to do meditation in the dark because it's kind of spiritual. But when you're really up all night, it's a good idea to have a fluorescent light on or so on, simply because of how tricky the mind is and how the brain works and so on. The brain works that way. When there's light, it says, okay, it's still daytime, and it stays up. Like, you know, these roosters that crow at 2 in the morning because people leave the fluorescent lights on and so on. I'm trying to think. There's a better example. I can't remember what it was now. There's something about when you leave the light on, I don't remember what it was. Anyway, reflecting on looking at the light, looking up at the stars, looking up at the moon, and so on. Staying in the open, because again, the mind is very tricky. When you get in a closed space, it starts to get drowsy and distracted. When you're out in the open air or up on a mountain or so on, out in a field, the mind becomes alert because of how it perceives. And this is a lot of these things are just for beginners, and they're really not going to help us in the end. In the end, we just have to focus on these things and, as I said, come to see them clearly. And that's what's being said in the actual sutta. I'm just reading you the commentary explanation and sort of some helpful, like the Cole's notes, helpful tips on the path. But really, we're talking about when you have sensuality, you know that there's sensuality. When there is anger in the mind, you know that there is anger in the mind. It's not a judgment at all. But these are some also helpful tips. Number five, companionship with the good and stimulating talk. Yeah, it's the same as the other ones. Number four, agitation and worry. These are actually two different things. Agitation is when your mind is distracted. Worry is like guilt when you've done bad things before. Worrying about something that you did wrong or worrying about something you did, thinking that it might have been the wrong thing or so on. Six things are conducive to casting out these. Number one is knowledge. When you know something, your mind becomes settled. Because the mind is not thinking over it, or is not the mind is calm and is settled on the knowledge and the certainty. And not being worried because one knows whether something is right or wrong. If one has done something bad and one knows that it is bad, one doesn't need to worry about it. One just says, I won't do that again. And knowledge about not worrying about bad things. When you've done bad things, let the past be the past and don't do it again. And also, knowledge is useful because it stops you from doing bad things. So when you haven't done bad things, there's no need to worry. Number two is questioning. So asking about what is right and wrong so you don't do bad things, and questioning to get a certain answer so that you don't have to think up the answers yourself. Like when you listen to a talk on teaching and then you get the answer, so then your mind is at rest and your mind is not distracted. I think this is more focused on the worry side, these ones, because it seems these are more to do with helping to stop you from doing bad deeds. When you haven't done bad deeds, then you don't feel so guilty. Number three, understanding the disciplinary rules. So these are the rules for monks. But understanding morality, understanding what is moral, what is immoral, so that you don't do immoral things. Number four, association with those more experienced and older than oneself in the practice of things like virtue. So association with people who keep moral precepts. When you associate with people who don't keep moral precepts, you will feel very guilty with the things that you do and say and get involved in. And number five, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number, well, that was number, I think I missed one. One, two, three, four, five. Right, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number six, stimulating talk. that helps the rejection of mental agitation and worry. And number five, this is where I'll stop after this one. Number five is doubt. And doubt can be really the worst of them all, as I've mentioned before. When a person has doubt about what they're doing, this is what sort of takes them off the path, what gets them to stop meditating. When they're not sure of how to proceed, so then they cannot go forward. When they doubt about their teacher, when they doubt about their practice, when they doubt about themselves, their ability to do things, this is what really gets in the way of a meditator's practice. So this is very much a hindrance. So what do we use to throw out doubt? Number one, again, besides simply acknowledging the doubting, which is mentioned in the sutta. In the sutta, it's basically stated that when there is doubt, one knows that there is doubt. When there is no doubt, one knows that there is no doubt. So when we have doubt, just saying to yourself, doubting, doubting, being aware, and then when it's gone, then coming back to the ordinary meditation practice. Simply knowing that it's there, seeing it for what it is, and realizing what's going on with the doubt, that there's the object of the doubt, and there's the doubt, and they really have no relationship. There's no reason to be doubting anything. Just be aware of it for what it is, and you'll be happy, be at peace. But there are things which are generally helpful. Number one, being learned in the Buddhist teaching, because when you learn about the Buddhist teaching, there's no need to doubt. You know what's the path and what's not the path. Number two, inquiring about the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. So inquiring about the Triple Gem, because when you learn about the Buddha, when you learn about his teachings, when you learn about who he considers to be his enlightened followers, then you get faith. You have great faith in this, because you see that the Buddha was not a god, he was not a tyrant, he was not asking people to just believe him. The Buddha was someone who knew truly what was real about the world, and what was simply conception, a concept, and he was able to tell the difference. He was a great teacher. He was someone who was esteemed by human beings and by angels and so on. And when we see this, then we have great faith, because we say, wow, this is someone to be confident in. We learn about the teaching of the Buddha, that it is ehipasiko, that it's inviting you to come and see for yourself. It's not asking you to believe. It's something that the more you practice, it's opanayiko. The more you practice, the more it pulls you in, the more keen you are on practicing. It's not like you practice a little way and then it gets boring, but the more you practice, the more keen you are to practice it, because you see the results. It's something to be realized for the wise by the wise for themselves. It's not something that we just speculate about or tell ourselves, but people who are going to realize it are those who put the effort in their meditation practice. Number three, of understanding thoroughly the nature of the discipline, the nature of morality. Number four, being decided about the truth of the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. So when we make up our mind about the truth of what they had to say, of what the Buddha had to say. I'm out of order here anyway, but number five and number six, again, are sympathetic and helpful companionship and stimulating talk that helps to dispel doubt. So these are the five hindrances, and they are something that we have to work really hard on. They're really what's getting in our way. If we didn't have these, then our meditation would progress smoothly and we would all be very easily able to become enlightened. But since these are still in the mind for most of us, then we have difficulty, we have trouble in our meditation. And so you can see that it's important that we have many different means to cast these hindrances out. And in the end, the best one is simply to, as the Buddha says, be aware when it's there, be aware when it's gone. Be aware when you have these things, and sort of be aware of what's going on, what's really going on when you have liking or disliking or drowsiness or distraction or doubt. Because when you see what's going on, you're able to dispel it right away. You say, that's useless, that's foolish to be in such a state. So this is the talk for today. I'd like to thank you all for coming, and next week we'll hopefully finish the discourse.